You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. And coming up, we get to the bassy brass tacks of a Wisconsin question from a listener about the humble tuna, tuba, and the instrument's place in Wisconsinites' hearts. Now, winter time is traditionally story time for the Ojibwe people and the land we now call Wisconsin. And the Wisconsin Historical Society has been hosting a series of online events throughout January featuring Ojibwe storytellers from around the state. The final online forum will be tomorrow night at 7 with our next guest, and you can find the details under the related links section of our website at wpr.org/centraltime. Wanda McFagan is a tribal historic preservation officer for the St. Croix Chippewa of Wisconsin. And Wanda, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me why these stories, like the ones you'll be sharing tomorrow night, why these stories are important.
Well, they fill our time during winter, but they're also teaching stories and hold some morale and some values in there. And that's traditionally how we taught our children, is to talk with them.
And how did you first come about some of these stories, Wanda?
Well, I've been in preservation for 22 years. So at different gatherings, I've heard stories. A lot of Native people will refer that they were taught by their grandmothers, but I didn't know my grandmother. I was raised in the city, so I didn't have a strong connection to the traditions and the values. So I had to learn and kind of become like a sponge for knowledge. So, and I've just picked up different things along the way working in my position.
And without sharing the full story, one of those tales you'll be telling tomorrow night would be about the Ojibwe dream catchers. Can you explain a little bit about why they look different than the kind you'd normally think of or you'd commonly find in a store?
Well, that was a gift from what we call in English, she would be known as Spider Lady. She brought us that gift when it became hard for her to make it to all of the babies in the nation here. So she gifted us with that. Ours looks different from, I guess you would call maybe the Lakota version, what you see in stores and the common dream catcher that you see. Ours looks like a spider web that you would see if you go outside in the summertime. You see the spider web in the tree. Ours looks very similar to that. And the background is basically the same, you know, that it releases the good dreams and holds on to the bad dreams or something like that. I'm not sure if I'm getting that correct or not.
Wanda McFagan is a tribal historic preservation officer for the St. Croix Chippewa of Wisconsin, and she'll be presenting tomorrow evening through the Wisconsin Historical Society stories of the series of the Ojibwe storytellers, and you can find the link at wpr.org/centraltime. And Wanda, what are you hoping people take away from the stories that you share tomorrow night?
Just a little bit of thought, maybe some seeds for our people to think about, you know, and some of them are teachings, so they may get something out of them, at least I'm hoping. And just education. Education is very important to us.
Planting some seeds and hope that come spring they may grow.
Yep, I'm hoping.
Hey, Wanda, I want to thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Lee, and it was nice talking with you.
pleasure's mine. Wanda McFagan, Tribal Historic Preservation Officer for the St. Croix Chippewa of Wisconsin. And you can hear more of her stories tomorrow night in a free online forum hosted by Wisconsin's Historical Society. And again, you can find the related link on our website at wpr.org/centraltime. But now it's time for Wisconsin Life. And here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about an upcoming Western Wisconsin ski jump tournament.
Volunteers are busy in Westby, Wisconsin, getting ready for the Snowflake Ski Club's annual tournament. As WPR's Ezra Wall tells us, this year is extra special since the club is celebrating its 100th year.
It's a windy night in Westby as volunteers with the Snowflake Ski Club groom the hills below the 5 and 10 meter ski jumps. The temperature is mild by Wisconsin winter standards, and about a dozen elementary school age kids are getting ready for practice. For 100 years, nestled in the steep hills of the Driftless area, this club has taught generations of athletes. Members have also hosted ski jumpers from around the world for its annual tournament. Just across County P from the ski jump is Snowflake's clubhouse. That's where I met Dan Ellefson. The Westby native learned to jump on the club's smaller hills as a kid before braving the big jump, which measures over 100 meters.
I was 20, I think, the first time I skied the big hill. Most guys get there before that. The holy smokes, am I high. It was fun. I got to the bottom of the hill, and I thought I made it, and I fell backwards, and I got up, and I said, I can't wait to get back up there. You're probably in the air 3 to 4 seconds, but when you're flying through the air and just watching the ground go by underneath you, it feels like a long time. Time goes pretty slow.
Back across the county road at the smaller jumps, coaches are working with kids from 5 to about 10 years old.
Butt lower. So I want to see that all the way down until you're ready to jump.
So you want me that low?
I want you low. And if you think you're low, go lower.
Janine Morley's whole household is a Snowflake family. Her husband is a volunteer, and her oldest daughter, Mackenzie, is this year's Snowflake Queen. Tonight, Janine is here to watch and help coach her 9-year-old daughter, Maddie.
Definitely balance, their in-run, you know, the proper form, that type of thing is super important. You know, the form more so, you know, they really want that form, not so much, you know, like these littles, how far they can jump, but just being able to get down and be in that in-run when they go down to land. And yeah, so you can really see a difference in the kids when they have the correct form, you know.
Snowflake's most prominent local export was Lyle Swenson, who captained the American ski jumping team in the 1964 Olympics in Innsbruck, Austria. Morley says renewed energy around the club's youth program has folks hoping for an equally bright future, especially among the club's teen competitors.
You could tell there's definitely some that are really excelling here. Yeah, we've got some that are just amazing to watch already this year. And they've been traveling this year already. Eau Claire last weekend, Minneapolis, I believe they're going to be at this weekend with quite a few of these guys too.
Coach Derek Lundy is a third-generation Snowflake ski jumper. He's coaching his kids, the fourth generation of Lundys, to jump in Westby.
Certainly makes a proud dad to see him come down that jump, and I see a lot of similarities from just the style of the kids, how they jump, and then the style of what I would do when I was a kid, so it's kind of neat to see that.
But as much as he enjoys coaching, he still remembers what it was like soaring off the jumps in his competitive days.
You know, you're basically flying, and there's not a lot of things that in this world that can make you feel like you're flying in the air. So it's the rush of that, and you know, once you do it once, it's pretty addicting.
Volunteers like Coach Derek Lundy are hoping this year's Snowflake Ski Jump Tournament helps propel the club into its next 100 years.
WPR's Ezra Wall brought us that story on the Snowflake Ski Club in Westby. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, a listener became enthralled and then curious about tuba culture in Wisconsin after moving here. So she asked us about it, and we've got her answers next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn. And that is Sotto Voce, the quartet, with two euphoniums and two tubas, performing the song Power, written by John Stevens. Why? Well, we recently received a question from a listener, Elizabeth Renner from Madison, and she asked,
why are tubas such a prominent part of the UW-Madison band, and why are they so popular in the state of Wisconsin?
Great question, Elizabeth. John Stevens is a longtime tuba performer and composer. In 1985, he joined the faculty of the UW-Madison School of Music, where he led one of the most prestigious low brass studios in the country. He was the tubist with the Wisconsin Brass Quintet and served as the director of the School of Music for 7 years. He retired from the university in 2014 and is now professor emeritus. And he wrote the piece we were just listening to. And Mike Forbes is just one of John's former students at UW and a performer on that recording. He currently plays principal tuba with La Crosse, Beloit Janesville, and Manitowoc Symphonies, and leads Wisconsin's premier large brass ensemble, the Isthmus Brass. He also teaches low brass at UW-La Crosse. Central Time producer Tim Peterson talked with them about Elizabeth's tuba questions.
So before we get to the Madison Marching Band, let's first talk about the popularity of tubas in Wisconsin. John, how did tubas get their start in the Badger State?
I think there's actually a lot of things that led to the popularity these days. The basic German culture of the state, I think, has a lot to do with it. Polka bands, bands and beer, if you will. The musical influences from the German culture have been a big part of that. Then there's also a strong Civil War band tradition in the state that I think all these years later still has sort of carried on. The Broadhead Brass Band, for example, was one of the more well-known bands in the Civil War era. And so that and the German culture and certainly what's happened here at UW-Madison with the popularity statewide of the marching band in particular, you know, people see the tubas and sousaphones all the time and, you know, it's just that's now become part of the culture as well.
And Mike, you've been playing with symphonies around the state you're currently playing. Could you talk a little bit more about the sort of statewide popularity at the local level?
Sure. There's something about the Midwest and bands in general that they're just much more proliferated around here than they are out east. For example, I'm originally from Pennsylvania, and we still have a strong Germanic culture there as well. But somehow the community bands aren't as present as they are in the Midwest. Every little town has its own unique community band or orchestra even. And in this case, I think a lot of the orchestras I play with kind of grew out of what was a community orchestra and then has become more of a professional orchestra, say, for example, the one in La Crosse and Manitowoc. A lot of this tradition just started, I think, again, from what John was mentioning, that early immigrant idea of having every town having its own brewery, its own band, and its own culture in its little area. Because, you know, travel was difficult, of course, back in those days. Today, we don't even think about crossing the state in a heartbeat. But back in those days, with horse-drawn carriages, you got your entertainment in your local community.
And Mike, our question asker Elizabeth, who moved to Madison a year ago, says since coming here, she feels like everyone she knows someone who plays a tuba, or everyone's dad plays a tuba. Does that sound pretty accurate to you?
Absolutely. I teach actually about 20 students here in the Madison area in private lessons, and about half of those are kids whose dad play the tuba. So there is something to be said about that. Also, anytime I go out and do like a little clinic for kindergartners, I can't tell you, as soon as I come in the door, all these hands shoot up. It's, oh, my dad plays that. And then I said, oh, yeah, what's it called? And they say, it's a trumpet. I'm like, no, it's a tuba. So
dagger.
There is some confusion sometimes.
Can we circle back to this polka music? How important is the tuba to polka?
I think the tuba is the largest, shiniest, most obvious visual instrument in any polka band. I think that actually has a lot to do with the popularity. I might make the analogy to, you know, the elephants at the zoo. I mean, it's an instrument that catches people's eye and their ear. Also, it's playing the bass line. It's playing something that is going on every second of every piece. You know, I mean, people sing the melodies, but I think there's also this, we all sort of feel this bass line when we're listening to a polka band or a rock band or any kind of band. And the association with the tuba or the sousaphone or both really resonates literally inside of people.
And Mike, you have brought a special guest to the studio, your tuba. Would you mind playing just a little example of this polka bass line?
Sure. I mean, it's just oscillating between sort of what, if you're any kind of a musician, the tonic and dominant for the most part. Something like that.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Mike. And we are talking with Mike Forbes, professional tuba player for multiple symphonies in Wisconsin and a low brass teacher at UW-La Crosse. We're also joined by John Stevens, a longtime tuba performer and composer and emeritus professor of music at UW-Madison. And we're answering a Wisconsin question about the popularity of tubas in Wisconsin and the prominence of that instrument in the UW-Madison marching band. And John, let's pivot to talking about that band. Again, our question asker, Elizabeth, was in awe seeing more than two dozen sousaphone players in UW's band compared with a much smaller number in her band when she was in high school. Why is this instrument such a prominent part of the Badger Band?
Well, this goes back quite a long way. The two most recent directors of the Badger Marching Band put together probably make up something pretty close to a century. Ray Dvorak and then Mike LaCrone have been, you know, at the helm of this group for a long, long time. And there have been various stages over the years of the way they used individual instrument sections. I think back in the 50s, the individual, like the trumpets or the trombones or the sousaphones would go into the stands and play and everything. And Mike LaCrone certainly took that tradition and made the most of it in terms of the sousaphone march thing that they do. And again, I think all the things that we've already been talking about contribute to this. They are front and center in the musical part of those football games every week. And, you know, when I first moved here in the 1980s, the UW football program was not especially at the high end of its competency. Mike actually put a lot of the current traditions into place back then, because, and that's when the whole marching band thing became so popular because, to be honest, for quite a few years there, it was the best thing that people saw and heard at the football game. And so people, again, when you see a number of sousaphone players walk into a stadium, it's a visual and visceral kind of thing in addition to the sound that you're hearing. So I think folks just, they just love to see it. You know, there's a little bit, the tuba or the sousaphone are kind of underdog instruments too. And, you know, around a lot of the country, the place where we live here in Wisconsin is often referred to as one of the flyover states. So there's a little bit of an underdog attitude perhaps about that too. I just think it's a natural, as Mike said before, here in the Midwest, the fit between the way people consider the tuba and where we live is a good one.
And Mike, you have taught players who have been in this band and learned a little bit more about the section. What else can you tell us?
Well, I know that they affectionately call these sousaphones rhinos because of the gigantic horn, you know, so that's and they love that idea. And I think another thing that John was kind of hinting at was that this sousaphone section, which, just for your listener to understand, the tuba is a little different looking than a sousaphone. The tuba is kind of sits on your lap and the bell points upward, whereas a sousaphone wraps around your body and you have the gigantic bell facing right out at the audience. But again, you heard me play some of that polka music where it's kind of this oscillation of two notes. It gets quite boring after a time. But, you know, the sousaphones, what made them really special, I think, or the rhinos, I should call them, is that they would actually play, you know, on Wisconsin and these other songs, and they'd actually play the main theme. They'd play the melody. So that was, of course, a hoot. Then when you hear essentially a bass line instrument all of a sudden get their hands on a melody and just squash it, you know, that's that's a lot of fun to listen to from an audience
perspective. Like a rhino would.
Exactly.
And some other tuba trivia I feel like we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about was, John, you also taught me something as we were setting up this interview, that tuba almost became the official state instrument of Wisconsin.
Yes, that's right. I moved here in 1985, but in 1984, a state senator, I think his name was Carl Oddie, proposed that the tuba become the Wisconsin state instrument. My understanding is that eventually the bill sort of died before it got anywhere. And I also understand that a number of years later, somebody wanted to do the same thing with the accordion. And that also, I don't want to say that it failed. It just sort of never got off the ground. So to the best of my knowledge, there is no official Wisconsin state instrument. But who knows? The day may come where the beloved tuba may have that honor.
I think it's a great place to leave it. Thank you so much, John and Mike.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And Elizabeth Renner, we are so glad you asked, why Wisconsin? That was Mike Forbes, professional tubist and low brass teacher at UW-La Crosse, and John Stevens, longtime tuba performer and composer and professor emeritus of music at UW-Madison. Our own Tim Peterson talked with them about the prominence and popularity of the tuba at UW and throughout Wisconsin. This conversation came to us from an audience question as part of the Why Wisconsin project. And we invite you to submit all your curiosities. What do you want to know about where we live and what happens here, whether it has to do with our brass, our football team, or maybe a little more on the accordion as our state instrument? What do you say? Submit your question, and we might answer it in a future story. Just go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. That's WPR.org/Wisconsin. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, affordable housing for elderly family members. We'll talk to the Resources Director for the Wisconsin Bureau of Aging and Disability, who offers affordable solutions for families. Plus, who to tip, how much, and when. We'll examine the complex evolution of gratuity and help you figure out a fair value so you're not spending too much and you don't sound cheap either. That's today on, or tomorrow on Central Time from 3 until 6. Now, coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then we talk with a pediatrician about new guidelines for childhood obesity. We'll look at long and short-term health effects and what treatments available for kids with obesity. That's coming up. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and you're listening to Central Time. Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up, five Memphis police officers are charged with second-degree murder after the beating death of Tyree Nichols. We'll talk with an expert on race about policing and about what needs to change and how to best go about it. First, new guidelines on childhood obesity say there's no reason to delay treatment for the complex disease and suggest it should be destigmatized. The guidelines released earlier this month by the American Academy of Pediatrics detail the long and short-term health effects of childhood obesity. Now, obesity rates around the country are increasing, and in Wisconsin, a 2020 study by the National Survey of Children's Health shows that almost 15% of 10 to 17-year-olds are considered obese. So join this conversation at 1-800-642-1234. What do you think about destigmatizing childhood obesity? Did you deal with childhood obesity as a kid? What treatments did you try? What worked or didn't work for you? And what do you wish you knew back then that you know today? Join us, 1-800-642-1234, or email us, ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Brian Lynch is a pediatrician at the Mayo Clinic Children's Center. He works with the American Academy of Pediatrics and co-leads a primary care obesity task force at the Mayo Clinic. Dr. Lynch, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Yes, I'm so happy to be here and a part of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Yeah, the American Academy of Pediatrics' new recommendation stressed that obesity is not just a consequence of poor eating habits or a lack of exercise, but obesity is a chronic disease with many intertwined causes, including genetics. And how does this inform the Academy when it came to the new guidelines for dealing with childhood obesity?
Yeah, first off, childhood obesity is a very significant public health problem. There's 14.4 million children and adolescents in the U.S. that have obesity. It makes it one of the most common pediatric chronic diseases. The percentage of U.S. children and adolescents with obesity has almost quadrupled from 5% in the mid-60s to 19% here in 2018. And the COVID pandemic is associated with even an increase in concerns with the obesity epidemic. So there's lots of things fueling this. And one of the things that we've learned, and it's not just diet and physical activity, but many social determinants of health, including family stress, can really be fueling this pandemic.
What about socioeconomic status?
Yeah, that's definitely a factor that's now much better understood to be a risk factor for obesity. And certainly poverty, race, the community, underserved communities, these are all risk factors for being obese outside of your dietary habits and your genetics.
So how has treating childhood obesity evolved as you see it, Dr. Lynch?
Well, with this statement, it's evolving a lot. The mainstay of treatment has been health behavior and lifestyle treatment. And this has been going on the last few decades, and it's most effective when it's face-to-face, when it involves the whole family, and when it delivers at least 26 hours of nutrition, physical activity, and behavior change over 3 to 12 months. And this can be done, you know, at different places in the community, at weight management clinics or at academic centers. But certainly the new statement discusses the use of especially earlier intensive therapy and the use of medications and bariatric surgery earlier than we've traditionally done.
And why the intensive early interventions with medications and potential for surgeries? Why is the American Academy of Pediatrics now looking at this for earlier and earlier in a child's development?
Well, for a few reasons. And most of the evidence shows that we really need to rethink our approach to childhood obesity treatment. Now, as I mentioned before, the epidemic grows, yet, you know, and our current interventions just haven't been effective. You know, with intensive health behavior and lifestyle treatment, we can get modest improvement, maybe 1 to 3% improvement in weight. If you add medications to that, at least some of the current ones that are new over the last 5 to 10 years, that can increase that up to 5%. And the numbers are staggering with bariatric surgery, where improvements can be sustained up to 20%. Of weight loss. So taking this data, we probably need to be utilizing these more aggressive interventions earlier than we have in the past.
Dr. Brown.
And one thing we know about obesity, if we can prevent it or we can mitigate the concerns with it early in childhood, we get a lot better outcomes.
Dr. Brian Lynch, our guest, pediatrician at the Mayo Clinic Children's Center, who works with the American Academy of Pediatrics and co-leads a primary care obesity task force at the Mayo Clinic. And you're welcome to join our conversation with the new guidelines out now from the American Academy of Pediatrics at 1-800-642-1234. Are you dealing with this in your own family today? And how are you dealing with it? And what questions would you have about dealing with it better? One of the factors that is included in this is genetics. Dr. Lynch, what can be done about our genetics?
Well, there are some things that can affect genetics. A lot we can't change, but certainly we're learning about epigenetics, the idea that your environmental and life experiences can really change, your genes in your body and what's then passed on to your offspring. So we've learned that through stress in society, through difficult times like wartime periods or plagues, that there can be multiple generational effects on health. So certainly we know that positive experiences in life, getting support from family and friends and neighbors, having safe neighborhoods, these things can have positive effects on epigenetics. Of course, we're learning about negative effects too, like adverse childhood experiences, like experiencing abuse and neglect, or, you know, living in an environment that's not supportive or experiencing racism or discrimination. So there are things that can affect genetics that we're really learning after the last decade. that can really potentially be areas that we can address with the obesity epidemic.
And Dr. Lynch, is this one of the reasons that the Academy of Pediatrics new guidelines call for when it comes for treatment of childhood obesity, not just intensive treatment with the child, but also the entire family?
Yes, there's lots of evidence that family-focused treatment plans are much more effective, and for many reasons. But, you know, certainly the mainstay of treatment is changing health habits. And if the whole family's doing that, it's a lot more effective and easier to implement than if it's just for one child within the family.
And what about socioeconomic status? How do you go about dealing with that?
Well, that's a much broader issue that, you know, difficult to solve in the clinic office. But I think it's important to understand and recognize that socioeconomic status and other social determinants of health do impact health status. And sometimes just explaining that to families can help them understand maybe why there's so many significant health problems they're experiencing, including obesity. At a societal level, though, it just shows how important it is to try to impact these social determinants of health and how it affects not only the obesity epidemic, but other chronic health diseases also.
Let us go to your calls now at 1-800-642-1234 with our guest, Dr. Brian Lynch, pediatrician at the Mayo Clinic Children's Center. Sue in Eau Claire, good afternoon.
Hi, I'm just wondering what work, if any, has been done in relation to looking at the levels of organophosphates and other herbicides, pesticides that are applied to food, and how that might contribute to obesity. I've worked with adults with obesity, and from a functional medicine perspective, which is approved by the AMA, there is testing that can be done, and some of those levels in us, in the adults, are extremely high, and lowering those can help with digestion and absorption, which contributes to helping with the obesity. And I'll take my answer off air unless there's further questions.
Sue, I appreciate your questions. And Dr. Lynch, what do we know about the connections between obesity and organophosphates or other pesticides?
Yeah, I'm not aware of any studies with organophosphates or other pesticides, but there is lots of data that processed food intake and sugar-containing food intake are definitely fueling factors for this obesity epidemic. And these are things we need to address both at an individual level and societal level to try to make these less healthy and unhealthy foods less available for the general public.
And what role, what place do sugary drinks have in that equation?
Oh, they certainly have a large piece. Certainly, that's one of the things I emphasize when I'm in my pediatric practice and talking to families. And that's really all families, not just with families with children with obesity. But to focus on trying to cutting down on sugar-containing beverages and try to drink more water and low-fat milk, you know, is the primary beverage intake. Because when you drink a sugary beverage, you're generally not very full. You still might be getting a lot of calories, and then you tend to eat even on top of that. So, you know, and because these are so readily available and cheap, certainly it's been something that's fueled this epidemic over the last three decades.
We're talking with Dr. Brian Lynch, a pediatrician at Mayo Clinic's Children's Center. He works with the American Academy of Pediatrics and co-leads a primary care obesity task force at Mayo Clinic. And you're welcome to join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. What do you think about how we treat childhood obesity? What would you like to see change when it comes to how we approach childhood obesity as a nation, in our society, in our households? And what questions do you have about how we can do better for our kids? 1-800-642-1234 or email us ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our conversation with Dr. Brian Lynch, a pediatrician at Mayo Clinic's Children's Center, taking a look at new guidelines for childhood obesity and how to treat this complex disease. What questions do you have? 1-800-642-1234. What stories do you have to share about childhood obesity in the U.S. and your household? What do you think about its treatments? Join us, 1-800-642-1234, or email us ideas at WPR.org. And Dr. Lynch, if you would just briefly go through some of these treatments, the guidelines talk about. What do these treatments look like?
Yeah, so the first-line treatment is still the same as it's been the last, you know, 3 decades, and that's intensive health behavior and lifestyle treatment. Now, that's ideally done at a comprehensive clinic that are usually, you know, at an academic medical center or in the community. Unfortunately, these treatment facilities aren't available in many communities in the United States, and families should then work with their pediatric health care providers, local dietitians, psychologists, exercise specialists, and other community resources to address behavioral health change. Every community has different resources that can be helpful. Here, where I work in Rochester, Minnesota, there's been lots of great programming with the schools, the YMCA, and the Boys and Girls Club, among many other organizations.
And Dr. Lynch, when we are figuring out if a child is obese or not, what are our measurements like, and are we accurate in using them? Are we missing obesity to some degree with the way we measure it? Or what do you think about the BMI and how we count somebody as obese?
Yeah, that's a great question. So weight status in our pediatric clinics is defined using the body mass index percentile, which is the weight in kilograms divided by the height in meters squared, and then plotted out in a percentile line based upon age and sex. So it's essentially a body thickness level. And for most individuals, the body mass index is well correlated with direct measures of body fat. So in generally, it does a good job. Certainly, we run into times it's not as effective, especially with children, adolescents with a lot of muscle mass. But, you know, in terms of defining obesity, typically it's defined as overweight if you're at the 85th percentile up to the 95th. If you're above the 95th, you're considered obese. If you're above the 99th percentile, it's severe obesity.
Dr. Brian Lynch, our guest, pediatrician at the Mayo Clinic Children's Center, works with the American Academy of Pediatrics and co-leads a primary care obesity task force at Mayo Clinic. And we return to your calls, questions, and stories this afternoon at 1-800-642-1234. We're Dave and Verona standing by. Dave, good afternoon.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I've got a question for the doctor. I know there's a tremendous focus on childhood obesity, but I wonder if there's a disconnect in that when parents bring their children into doctors' offices, is it your opinion that doctors are pretty aggressive at pointing out obesity issues, or is there a big concern about body shaming such that they really don't address those issues when parents bring their children in for physicals, for example? I'll hang up and listen to the answer.
Dave, thank you. Dr. Lynch?
Yeah, Dave, that's a great question. So it's very important to acknowledge that individuals with obesity experience weight stigma, victimization, teasing, and bullying, all which contribute to that child or adolescent having social isolation, avoidance of healthcare services, maybe decreased physical activity, and even potentially disordered eating behavior. And so I do think it makes many practitioners hesitant sometimes to address this as aggressively as currently recommended in this new policy statement from the American Academy of Pediatrics. I think that we can work with families to accept body shape and address weight status at the same time. And I think a lot of it has to do with how we discuss and talk about the problem. And I think this relates to practitioners, but it also just relates to all of us. For one, I think it's important to acknowledge that obesity is primarily a societal problem. It's not a personal choice issue. And we really need to work on providing empathy to individuals who have obesity. Secondly, I think we need to avoid stigmatizing language. Like in the clinic, I try to use terms like unhealthy weight, or I use that body mass index percentile when discussing weight status, and stay away from words like obese or chubby. It's also important to use first-person language. So an example of that would say a child with obesity rather than calling a child an obese child. And lastly, as a practitioner, it's very important that I try to be sensitive and compassionate in communicating with families and really focus my efforts on the habits more than the weight goal. So we've really shifted that in the last 5 to 10 years because that helps prevent eating disorders, plus it helps really focus on things that are doable and feasible for families to address.
So when you talk about obesity as a societal problem, you would also talk about obesity in terms of a family solution, correct?
Yes, I mean, there's both factors. But yeah. the primary driver, in my opinion, of this epidemic over the last three decades is issues with society. You know, the socio-ecological environment, the overall environment, versus the personal choice issues, which are still important and can still impact outcomes, but I think they're not the primary drivers. It's just very difficult to sustain healthy behavior changes in an environment that promotes high energy intake foods, unhealthy dietary choices, and sedentary behavior, including lots of recreational screen time.
Let's continue with your calls now for Dr. Brian Lynch. Charlene and Eau Claire, good afternoon. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm just a little frustrated at your guest's continual contention that kids are getting fat because of lifestyle choices. And he was also saying it's because of socioeconomic factors. They're poor or because of stress in the home. Well, I was a kid in the 70s from an alcoholic family, plenty of stress. And then after my parents got divorced, we were poor. After my parents got divorced, my single mom was too tired to cook, so she fed my brother and I on a steady diet of Burger King and McDonald's. We drank tons of sugary pops. I had, you know, those are all, and we sat around playing video games all day. Those are all the factors he listed, and yet my brother and I and all our friends going through the same thing, we're not fat. What's the difference? It's because of all the chemicals in the food and endocrine disruptors that are in all the chemicals that are everywhere now. And I'm just frustrated that they keep saying it's, you know, lifestyle changes. It's not. And there are a lot of these things, well, some of it might be, but a lot of these are things we can't do anything about. And it's super frustrating. And it's, you know, not just childhood obesity, it's adult obesity too. We're all affected by these things.
Charlene, thank you. I believe we did mention genetics as one of the other things that would not be necessarily a controlling factor in this, but one of the factors in it. But what about the stigma, Dr. Lynch? And can that stigma of obesity actually compound the problem?
Certainly, the stigma is a huge issue, and that's one thing that I'm glad that this policy statement addressed. And as I mentioned before, it's very important that we all recognize that there is a stigma with obesity and work to mitigate that. We have a long way to go as a society to do that. And Charlene, thanks for sharing your story. And certainly you've been through a lot in your life, and you've had, good outcomes with your weight status. And I've discussed things that have evidence that are generally things that we can do and impact. There's lots of things impacting this epidemic that a lot of us don't have any impact on. And that's a major problem. And I guess one of the points I want to make sure our audience understands is that a lot of this is societal level problems. They're going to take public policy, higher level changes to really impact health in making our food healthier and making healthy food more affordable and cutting out things in foods that are unhealthy. And like I said before, the most evidence of concern currently is with the processed foods and sugar-containing foods. So these are big things, but every individual is different. And we focus on concerning individual factors. There's also many protective individual factors that can help promote healthy outcomes, not just with weight, but with other chronic diseases also. And it's important, anytime we look at someone's health, we look at what the challenging factors in their lives, but also the positive factors that can build it up. And I think we need to focus more on those positive factors, both in the medical office and in our society.
Dr. Lynch, we are out of time, but I thank you so much for yours this afternoon.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it a lot.
Dr. Brian Lynch, a pediatrician at the Mayo Clinic's Children's Center. He works with the American Academy of Pediatrics and co-leads a primary care obesity task force at the Mayo Clinic. He talked with us about the American Academy of Pediatrics' new guidelines regarding childhood obesity, including the long and short-term effects of the disease and childhood obesity treatment. And there's still time for you to join this conversation. Sorry we didn't get to all of your calls, but you can always email us and we'll continue it at ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Now, coming up after the news, we'll talk about the death of Tyre Nichols at the hands of the police in Memphis and what it tells us about policing in America, how far we've come and how far we have to go, and what it would take to make it safer. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Rob Ferret, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.